This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, everyone. I'm Tanya.
And I'm Talia.
And we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hey, Talia.
Hi, Tanya.
How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Great.
I'd like to welcome everyone back to another episode of Crimes and Consequences.
Welcome.
Before I tell you today's story, I would just like to remind everyone to hit the subscribe or follow button on whatever app you're listening to us on. Before I begin, I just want to give credit to my main source for today's story. It was an article written for Maclean's, which is a magazine in Canada. It was published March 3rd, 2016. It was written by Michael Friscalanti. It was a great article, and I recommend everybody read it because I only am giving you the tip of the iceberg. This article was huge. Our story begins on June 30th, 2009. And on that day, Constable Jeff Dempster was preparing to work the afternoon shift for the Kingston Mills Police Department, which is located in Ontario, Canada. And Kingston Mills is, just to give you an idea, it's about 3 hours northeast of Toronto.
Okay.
Constable Dempster's cell phone rang, and on the other line was one of his colleagues in the Major Crimes Unit. This colleague proceeded to tell Constable Dempster that a car was being pulled from the Kingston Mill locks, which is a body of water, and there were four bodies inside. Constable Dempster knew that this is going to be a long day. When he got to the police department, he was met with three members of the Shafia family. Father Muhammad Shafia, his wife Tuba Muhammad Yahya, and their son, 18-year-old Hamid Shafia. They were there to file a missing persons report for their family members. And the family members that they said were missing were their daughters, 19-year-old Zainab Shafia, 17-year-old Sahar, 13-year-old Giti, and their aunt, Rona Amir. And Rona was 50. As Constable Dempster is interviewing them, and based on the information he received about the bodies that were recovered in that car, he started to realize that he thinks that they're connected.
These must
be the people that are missing.
It's quite a coincidence.
Right. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Shafia family and give you some history. Muhammad Shafia was born to a middle-class family in the 1950s in Afghanistan. He quit school in the seventh grade, but that didn't prevent him from being an extremely financially successful man in his adulthood. He was a successful businessman in Afghanistan. He owned a small electronics shop, which he grew eventually into a multi-million dollar import-export business.
Damn.
I know. He originally exported Panasonic electronics, radios mostly, and Peacock brand thermoses, which those items were imported from Japan. And at the time, he was the only shop in the country that offered these goods, so therefore, he was very successful because they're high quality. In February 1979, Muhammad married his first wife, Rona. Their marriage was an arranged marriage, like many marriages in Afghanistan at the time. Muhammad's mother was the first to spot Rona and invited her to their home so she could meet her son.
What do you mean, just spot?
Just saw her out in the wild somewhere.
She's like, hey, you.
And she was beautiful, and she was like, oh, you need to come meet my son. After their first meeting, Muhammad agreed to marry Rona, and one of her brothers asked her if this is what she wanted. And she told her brother, quote, give me away in marriage if he's a good man, don't if he's not. Really, that's all she cared about was whether he was a good person or not. Rona wore a pretty, frilly, light blue dress to her wedding reception that had a matching veil.
How old was she?
She was probably about 20.
Oh, okay.
Okay. And they celebrated their union with a fancy reception in Kabul at the Intercontinental Hotel. Muhammad wore a purple suit with long sideburns, as was the fashion at the time. After they were married, Rona and Muhammad tried to have children but battled with infertility. Desperate in their attempts to conceive, they traveled to India to seek fertility treatments. However, they were not able ever to conceive.
Aww.
Muhammad began to mistreat Rona as a result, and she wrote in a diary that she kept, quote, my husband started picking on me. he wouldn't allow me to go visit my mother. And at home, he would find fault with my cooking and serving meals, and he would find excuses to harass me, end quote.
Because she couldn't have children?
Right.
And they didn't believe in adoption?
Apparently not. After about 10 years of trying, Rona knew how badly Muhammad wanted children, so I believe probably in a fit of anger or desperation, she said, just go take another wife.
Damn. I don't know about that. I don't know about that one.
I know, right? In 1989, Muhammad, who was now almost 30 years old, met 17-year-old Tuba Muhammad Yahya, who was a family member of one of Muhammad's friends. Muhammad remembers that Rona was thrilled to plan her husband and his new bride's wedding reception.
She's thrilled?
Yeah, apparently she was thrilled.
Oh my God, he's got to be clueless.
Right?
And I'm just saying.
She apparently said to him, quote, children are important to us and I want you to find another woman to marry.
Oh, she's a better woman than me.
Like you said, I find it really hard to believe that she was thrilled because Rona did write in her diary about it and described the marriage as, quote, I was visited with a new catastrophe.
Aww.
I know, I felt really bad for her.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta feel like shit.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a new bride. He's all over.
Who's 17, by the way.
Fuck. Talk about feeling like a third wheel.
I know, right?
Hell no.
When Tuba married Muhammad, she wasn't exactly in love with him. Because again, I believe this was probably an arranged marriage. So it had to be difficult for everyone and awkward, I would think, in the beginning. Rona is featured prominently in their wedding photographs, many showing Muhammad with each of his wives on either side of him.
Oh, how cute.
I know. The trio lived together in one household, which was customary at the time in Afghanistan.
It's a whole different world, man, out there.
I know,
oh, right? My blood's boiling right now, you know? Just thinking about it.
I know, me too, right? I don't know. Tuba became pregnant within weeks of her marriage to Muhammad, and their first child, a baby girl, who they named Zainab, was born in September 1989. Rona helped care for baby Zainab, caring for her alongside Tuba, while still hoping to conceive her own child. The second child born to Tuba and Muhammad was their daughter, Sahar, in October 1991. And this was kind of weird because Tuba gave the baby to Rona to raise as her own, kind of like, here.
Oh.
Yeah.
How thoughtful.
And Rona soon realized that the baby was sort of a bribe to her. Tuba announced that their husband, Muhammad, should spend 3 nights with her for every one that he spent with Rona.
Oh, but you get the baby.
But you get the baby. And Rona realized later that was Tuba's way of becoming the number one wife, slowly hoping to put a permanent wedge between Rona and Muhammad. It worked because not long after Sahar was born, Muhammad stopped having sex with Rona. A year later, Tuba and Muhammad's first son, Hamad, was born. And with his birth came a tumultuous time for the Afghan people. In 1992, Afghanistan became embroiled in a civil war, which caused this family of six to flee the country, and they headed to Pakistan initially. At the time of their leaving Afghanistan, Tuba was pregnant with child number four, a daughter whose name is protected from being publicized due to this case. But I'm going to call her Amy. And I'm sorry, but I'm giving her American names.
I like Amy. Amy's simple.
It's easy. Amy would eventually be born in Pakistan, along with her brother. Again, his name is protected, so I'm going to call him Bobby.
Amy and Bobby.
Me and Bobby. Tuba and Muhammad's sixth child was Giti, who at the start of our story, I told you, was one of the bodies found in the Kingston Mill Locks. Eventually, the family ended up in Australia, but their stay was brief. After that, they moved to the United Arab Emirates, where they stayed for almost 11 years. While there, Muhammad expanded his business to include selling used cars, and the children got a taste of Western culture and the personal freedom that went along with it. They went to an American private school.
Why did they do that?
I don't know, because the UAE is an Islamic country, so yeah. I'm not sure why they went to an American school. They learned English. They had friends that were from all over the world, so they were exposed to quite a bit. While in the UAE, Tuba and Muhammad's final child, child number seven, was born, and her name is also protected. So I'm going to call her Catherine. So we have ABC. Amy, Bobby, and Catherine.
Oh, you're so clever.
Yes. While the family lived in the UAE, Tuba learned to drive and positioned herself as the preferred wife for Muhammad. Rona was more reserved than Tuba and didn't fight or quarrel with the second wife. She was brushed aside and didn't question anything really that was being done. She
just kept her. So horrible.
I know. She just kept her life like as being submissive. I know it sounds terrible.
Oh, God.
Even though life was good in the UAE, the family didn't plan to stay there. Muhammad was looking for a country who would welcome his family with a path to citizenship, and the UAE wasn't it. They tried to emigrate to New Zealand at one point, but Rona didn't pass the medical exam.
Why?
I'm not sure. Like I said, they spent a year in Australia, but they had to come back to the UAE, and there are differing accounts as to why. Tuba claims it was because she and the children didn't like it there, but Roma claimed they were deported because Muhammad purchased property, which was a violation of the rules governing their visas, and the family was deported.
Mm.
Whatever ups and downs the family experienced, Muhammad found a way to punish Rona for it, or at least that's how she felt, because in her diary she said, quote, he made life a torture for me. Whatever I did, if I sat down, if I got up, if I ate anything, there was blame and censure attached to it. By 2007, Muhammad had amassed a small fortune and could consider himself a multi-multi-millionaire.
Oh, wow.
And he found the perfect place for the family to settle. Canada.
Canada, absolutely.
The province of Quebec had a program that allowed immigrants to invest in the province. And at the time, the financial minimum was $400,000. I believe today it's more than that, at least $800,000. If you did that, it was in exchange for permanent residence and eventual citizenship. Muhammad invested $2 million, mostly in cash, and bought a strip mall in Laval, which is on the outskirts of Montreal. And more cash was spent building a home for his large family. He had one problem, though, which was that he had two wives, which is illegal in Canada.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I don't think you can even do that in Utah anymore, can you?
I don't know. I don't think so. No, I think it's illegal in Utah, too. I watch Sister Wives. You don't watch Sister Wives?
No.
I have.
I did. I've seen it before.
Yes. I'm not a regular watcher, but I have seen it before. And he's only legally married to one of them. In 2007, Muhammad, Tuba, and their seven children immigrated to Canada and settled in the St. Leonard borough of Montreal. Rona was left behind, sent to live with relatives in Europe.
Damn.
I know. Muhammad's plan was to bring her to Canada eventually.
Why?
As a relative. I'm not sure why.
Like, why?
I don't know. You're right. I don't know because...
Why bother?
Why bother? You're right.
Just to treat her like shit?
Exactly.
So who's his legal wife?
They both are, according to Afghan law.
But in Canada?
In Canada, I'm not sure if they were only married in a religious ceremony in Afghanistan, you know, like in an Islamic ceremony. I don't know if they actually had a legal marriage, but I would imagine it would be Rona because she's the first one. When Rona was in Europe, being away from her family, this was the first time she had ever been away from them for any length of time, and she missed them so much. 6 months after the family settled in Montreal, Mohammed sponsored Rona's immigration, telling the government she was his cousin and she was going to work for the family as a cook and housekeeper. She arrived in Canada on a temporary visitor's visa, and Tuba made sure to put her in her place. She told Rona that her life was in her hands, and Rona was her servant.
Oh, my God.
I know. Rona just felt trapped. Here she is. She's in a loveless and abusive marriage. Tuba and Muhammad kept all of her identifying documents, including her passport. And Rona believed she couldn't go anywhere, even somewhere she had relatives. She just felt trapped. She felt like, you know, because they have my documents, she didn't understand. I mean, she probably could have went to, what do you call it, like a consulate or...
She doesn't know.
She doesn't know.
And she's beaten down.
Exactly. Rona moved into a bedroom with Giti and Sahar and slept on a mat beside the girls. Because initially when they moved to Canada, they lived in like, not temporary housing, it was kind of like an apartment or a home that they rented. Where they really didn't even unpack their furniture. They just sort of were waiting for their house to be built. Tuba ran the household while Rona was treated as less than the first wife. Muhammad set up his import-export business, and in Montreal, it exchanged clothing, household goods, and construction materials. Like I said, he also started the construction on the home that would eventually house the family of 10. The house was described as a $900,000 mansion.
And what year is this?
2007.
Okay.
And it was being built in an upscale suburb of Montreal. While the home was being built, like I said, the family rented a home in St. Leonard. It had four bedrooms and two bathrooms. Mohammed spent a lot of time on business overseas in Dubai, and it's been reported that between June 2007 and June 2009, when our story began, he only spent a total of 6 months in Canada. During this time, those 2 years that I said, the Shafia family never found their true success story. Instead, the family was ripped apart and destroyed due to the thing they came to Canada for, personal freedom. As I'd already mentioned, Mohammed was a man born in Afghanistan in the 50s. He had two wives, so I hope you understand what a traditional man he was. Tradition to his own culture's roots. He believed that his family was to honor him in every way. His children, despite spending almost 11 years being exposed to Western culture, were required to live as they would have if they had never left Afghanistan, which proved to be a problem that would eventually lead to 4 people dead. As Tuba and Mohammed's first son, Hamad, grew older, he was put in charge of the house. Despite being the third oldest in the family, he was instructed to be the eyes, ears, and fists of Mohammed.
Well, he was it because he could be like the enforcer?
Mm-hmm, because he was a boy. So he had to enforce the house rules. It included keeping his sisters in line. The oldest daughter, Zainab, warned her classmates about Hamad. When she got a Valentine from a classmate in February 2008, this boy sent her a card, like a Valentine's Day card. So she sent him an email that said to be aware of her brother. If her brother's around, you have to act like we're complete strangers.
Wow.
And we can only talk if he's not around, because she said she didn't want him to get the slightest idea that they were friends. About a month later, when both Zainab's parents were in Dubai, the classmate that I'm telling you about, his name was Amar, was found in the Shafia's garage hiding from her brother, Hamid. Zainab had invited him over, not realizing that Hamid was on his way home. After that happened, Zainab was not allowed to return to school and was forced to remain in her bedroom.
What?
She couldn't leave the house unless she was accompanied by a relative. They kept her hostage, basically.
How old is she? Like 16?
She's like 17.
Oh, my.
16, 17, yeah, at this time.
Lord have mercy.
Maybe even 18. Her sister, Sahar, was also struggling to life at home. Tuba had accused her, and she is, I think, probably 2 to 3 years younger than Zainab. Tuba had accused her of kissing a boy at school, and Tuba showed up to the school to give one of Sahar's teachers hell. Little sister Amy acted as her mother's translator, and Tuba told the teacher that Sahar shouldn't be kissing boys at school, as it was against their values. You imagine how horrifying
this had to be. That teacher. Oh, Lord, have mercy on her. She's probably like, what the hell is this shit?
Sahar was so distraught after this visit, she tried attempting suicide by drinking water mixed with the silica gel packets from a shoebox she found.
Aww.
Rona and Giti were beside themselves over this, but Tuba was unaffected, and she said basically, she can go kill herself. She can go right to hell. Like, she didn't care. Sahar survived, but went for help at school.
How do you not care as a parent?
I know, it's your daughter.
Mom? Like, how do you? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. On May 7th, 2008, Sahar was visited by BATSHA, which is Quebec's child welfare agency. And the agency showed up where Sahar was in the vice principal's office at school. She started telling them of all the goings on at home. She was being pressured to wear a hijab. She had tried to commit suicide. Her brother, Hamid, had thrown a pair of scissors at her.
Ooh.
She said her sister Amy spied on her and reported it to Tuba.
Amy!
I know, Amy. And Tuba had stopped talking to her over the last several months and had told her siblings to stop talking to her, too. When Sahar found out the welfare agency was going to talk to her family, she recanted her story and just begged them not to visit her parents.
She I bet.
Terrified, right?
Probably going to get her ass beat or something.
I know. Yeah, absolutely. But the agency had to follow protocol. And worker Jeannie Rowe called the Shafia's home and asked the family to meet her and Sahar at the school. Tuba arrived first with Zainab. Tuba denied everything Sahar said. And Zainab agreed, even though she did say that Sahar didn't want to wear the hijab at school. Mohammed, along with Hamid, came in after Tuba and Zainab, and he was visibly angry. He demanded to know the source of the report, but Jeannie Rowe wouldn't say who did. And so then he threatened a lawsuit because he said the report was just filled with lies.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh.
Good luck with that lawsuit.
I know. Jeannie returned to the school 2 days later to do a follow-up and found Sahar wearing a hijab and minimizing the event she had reported just 2 days prior. Sahar told her she wanted to go home and therefore, assessing no further risk, Jeannie closed the case. During the same time, so all this fucking shit's going on, Rona had been leaving the house to use payphones to talk to her relatives, and she was reporting what was happening in the house. She told them of how miserable she was and how she wished God would just take her, and she cried over the hopelessness that she felt. One of her family members was so concerned, she got Rona in touch with another family member. Her name was Fahima Vorgets. She was an Afghan woman living in Virginia who advocated for women's rights. Fahima spoke with Rona up to 3 times a week, and Rona would tell her how Muhammad would beat her and humiliate her, and how badly she wanted a divorce. Fahima encouraged Rona to take a class or learn something, which Rona told her Muhammad would never allow, just as he wouldn't allow a divorce. Rona reported to her that Muhammad told her he would kill her before he allowed her to leave.
He doesn't even want her. That's the thing.
Right? That's what I don't get. Before I tell you more, we're going to take a break. Zainab was finally allowed to return to school a few months after her 19th birthday, but not the same one where she had known Amar. She was allowed to take morning classes by herself, and I'm thinking this was probably like an adult education type facility. But Tuba and Hamad joined her for a French class at night. She was soon in touch with Amar again by email, and she told him how much she missed him. She said, quote, "I still remember the way you told me you loved me and the first time," end quote. At the end of the note, Zainab said she still cried about the day her brother caught him at the house. "Baby, work hard," she said. "Make something out of yourself. I will be so happy," end quote. Zainab and Amar rekindled their relationship at the beginning of 2009 when they started sneaking visits, again, sometimes meeting at the library or a local McDonald's. Sahar and her new boyfriend, Ricardo, would often join them. Ricardo was introduced to Sahar by Zainab, and Ricardo was another student in her French class. Ricardo had recently immigrated to Canada with his family from Honduras.
Oh.
Yeah, and he was 4 years older than Sahar, but Zainab thought he was really nice, and he just really wanted Sahar to meet him.
They know they're playing with fire, right? Yeah, with their parents. Right. Like, oh, Lord.
I know.
4 years older from Honduras.
Mm-hmm. I know. At first, Ricardo thought her name was Natasha, mostly because he spoke Spanish and she spoke English. They kind of had this language barrier. But soon they were spending as much time with one another as they possibly could and made promises of marriage to one another.
Wow.
Ricardo lived with his aunt, and she remembers that Sahar told her that if her parents ever knew about her relationship with Ricardo, they would kill her. Zainab and Sahar's 13-year-old sister, Giti, was also struggling with life under the oppression of their father. Giti had spent most of her life in the UAE, and she loved makeup and fashion, and she rebelled against the rules her father tried to impose. A turning point happened in April 2009 when Giti was at a mall with her younger siblings, Amy and Bobby, and they got home later than they were expected to be home. Muhammad was so angry at them being late, he and Hamad beat all three children while Zainab watched. And this was just the turning point for Zainab. She had had enough, and within the next couple days, she escaped from the house on April 17th, 2009. She left a note behind saying, quote, "I want to live my own life," end quote, and the family couldn't find her. Hamad called 911 twice and reported her missing. Zainab found refuge at a local women's shelter, and the news of her escape reached her younger siblings at school, namely Sahar, Giti, Amy, and Bobby.
Well, her parents can't do anything about it.
Right.
She's 19 years old.
The four children, though, were so scared of Muhammad's reaction when they got home, they decided to go to a stranger's house and ask that stranger to call the police for them for protection. So now we've got three calls to the police, right? They were correct in their fear of Muhammad because he was blind with rage when he found out that Zainab had ran away. He feared the worst. He thought, oh, my daughter, who's only a few months away from her 20th birthday, she has totally betrayed her family because she's probably out there having sex. You know, just horned
she's
up.
She's a hoe.
And even if she wasn't, he was convinced everyone thought that she was, and that was just as bad. Montreal Police Constable Anne-Marie Chiquette responded to the 911 calls and first found Sahar, Giti, Amy, and Bobby at the neighbor's house and escorted them home. While she was with them, she interviewed them on their own. Giti told Constable Chiquette how her father had beaten her the week prior over being late home from the mall, and how he had pulled her hair and Hamad had punched her in the face. She also told the constable that her father often told her that he was going to kill her for disobeying the rules he had laid down for the siblings to follow. Sahar told Constable Chiquette that Hamad also had slapped her and that she saw her father beat Zainab over her relationship with her boyfriend, Amir. Sahar confirmed that both she and Giti feared for their lives and wanted to leave home. Bobby confirmed that his older brother Hamad used physical punishments and that Muhammad also threatened physical violence to all the kids. Constable Chiquette noticed Amy had a mark near one of her eyes, but what she told the police has never been revealed, what Amy's told the police. While the kids were speaking with Constable Chiquette, Muhammad came home, pulling into the driveway, and as soon as they saw him, they all stopped talking, and Amy immediately recanted whatever she had said, tearfully saying it wasn't true.
Man.
I know. I feel so bad for these kids. A social worker from the Child Welfare Agency also visited and talked to Tuba, Muhammad, and Hamid. The social worker determined that the children were safe in the home and told the family he'd be back after the weekend was over to continue his investigation. This was the opposite of what Constable Chiquette believed, but
she's like, come on.
It can't be safe. But she had to follow the proper procedures, which was to allow child services to make the ultimate decision. On April 20th, Detective Lori Ann Laferbe got involved in the case. Her primary focus was on cases involving child abuse, and she visited the kids at school and re-interviewed Sahar, Giti, Amy, and Bobby, along with the child welfare caseworker. Amy continued to deny her original statements, but the other children gave the police an earful. Giti even asked to be placed in foster care immediately, saying she had no freedom. Sahar continued to complain that the children suffered physical abuse at the hands of Hamad and that he was the enforcer when Muhammad was out of town. Despite these complaints...
How old is that shithead?
He's a year younger than Sahar. Despite these complaints, no charges were ever filed and the child welfare case was closed. So where we last left Zainab, she was at a women's shelter. She contacted her mom, Tuba. And Tuba convinced her to come back home.
No.
Telling her, you know, if you really are in love with Amir, she could marry him. You know, come home and we'll plan the wedding. And I saw an interview with Amir that was on that TV show, The Fifth Estate, the Canadian, news show.
Yeah.
And he said he convinced her, too, because Tuba had said, you know, if you come home and you still want to marry Amir and your father disagrees with it, I'll move out with you. We'll get an apartment where you can stay until the wedding.
Wow, she must have been very convincing.
Yeah, which obviously didn't happen. Zainab came back home on May 1st, 2009, as Muhammad left for another business trip in Dubai. Before she returned home, Rona overheard a conversation that Muhammad had with Tuba and Hamad, where he said, I'm going to go to Afghanistan. I'm going to prepare the documents, I'm going to sell my property, and then I'm going to kill Zainab. She also overheard him say, I will kill the other one too, which she believed meant her, Rona. Rona was so upset and scared by this conversation, she told her sister about it. Her sister was in France, and she told her, don't worry, you know, don't be afraid. This isn't Afghanistan. It's not Dubai. You're in Canada. Nothing's going to happen to you. Tuba didn't want Zainab marrying Amir, and tried everything to get her to back out. She even got one of her brothers, Fazil, involved, asking him to talk to Zainab, which he did several times. Zainab told him, I'm set in my decision, and I'm going to do it because I need to escape from this house. And even though I love Amir, it might not be the best time for us to get married, but I'm doing it because I need to get out. Fazil wanted to come to Montreal and meet Amir. He lived in Sweden because he wanted to make sure that Amir could take care of Zainab properly. So he has a phone conversation with Muhammad to tell him of his travel plans. Like, I'm going to come. I'm going to visit with Amir. And during their phone conversation, Muhammad told him what he really had in store for Zainab. And that was to murder her before her wedding because she had dishonored the family. Fazil was so shocked, he hung up on Muhammad. after Muhammad tried to get him to help, like he said, why don't we send Zainab to Sweden and we'll kill her there? And he's like, fuck no.
That's crazy.
It's crazy. And so after he hung up with Muhammad, Fazil called his sister, Tuba, and another brother who lived in Montreal, like, to warn them, saying, this is insane. He wants to kill Zainab. But he never directly warned Zainab. Sahar was spending a lot of time with Ricardo at this time, and they talked about running away together. But one thing that prevented her from leaving her family was her little sister, Giti. They were very close and basically inseparable. Giti would write in her notebook about Sahar, like S plus G for life.
Aww.
I don't know what I would do if you left. You know, what if I'm left in this house? What am I going to do? And she just said, I promise before I die, I'll make all your wishes come true. Aww. To her sister. They were super close. Zainab and Amir were married in an Islamic ceremony on May 18th, 4 weeks before her body would be found in the car in the locks.
So they got married.
They did, but no one from Amir's family attended the wedding because they also didn't approve of him getting married. And the embarrassment of it all overwhelmed Tuba to the point she fainted. So she makes this big-ass scene at the wedding, and the circumstances surrounding the wedding were so bad that Zainab asked for a divorce immediately. Like, they hadn't even left, like, the reception.
Wow.
And she was so upset because her mom passed out, and she's like, okay, mom, I'll get divorced.
Did her dad go?
No, he was in Dubai.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay.
So she asked for the divorce immediately, like I said. What? And Amir agreed to it.
What?
I know. And Zainab said about the wedding that, quote, I can't do this. I can't ruin my family's reputation, end quote. And Amir agreed. He said, quote, obviously we loved each other, so it hurt both of us, end quote. They were considered divorced before leaving the reception. Tuba and her brother, Latif, so this is another brother she has, decided they could restore honor to the family by having Zainab marry one of his sons. Latif called Muhammad in Dubai and told him of this plan.
Is it like a cousin?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And Muhammad seemed to be on board, despite saying that if he had been there for the wedding, he would have killed Zainab himself. A few days after this debacle, Sahar and Ricardo were caught hugging one another in a restaurant by her brother, Hamid. Hamid left on June 1st to catch a flight to Dubai to see his father and to tell him of the dishonor that Sahar put on the family. And he brought along with him photos of Sahar and Ricardo together.
Oh.
And they're like hugging and they're physically touching. In Dubai, searches were made on Hamad's laptop for, can a prisoner have control over their real estate? He looked for Canada Mountains with Lake in Quebec. After Hamad left for Dubai, Zainab sent Amir an email and she said, quote, we had an amazing love story together. It was my dream to marry you. And I did it once, so if something happens to us like dead, I want to die with my dream being fulfilled. In another email, she told him that her father was coming home soon and basically said that she's going to have to go to the airport and say that she's sorry and like beg him for forgiveness. And she said, I hope he just forgets everything. Giti was also heading into a downward spiral. She was failing all of her classes at school, and she was sent home for a dress code violation wearing a low-cut sweater. She was caught shoplifting at Walmart.
Oh,
I know. Where she had a pink camisole and leggings that she was trying to lift. She was quite vocal about her unhappiness, telling anyone she met that she wanted to leave her home. Her big mouth made her a target. Muhammad and Hamid came home to Montreal on June 13th, and Zainab met them at the airport where her father kissed her on the forehead and said he forgave her for everything. A few days later on June 19th, Hamid canceled Zainab's cell phone. The following day, searches continued on his laptop. This one said, where to commit murder. He Googled that.
Oh, okay.
On June 22nd, Muhammad bought a used car. It was the Nissan Sentra that the bodies were found in. And he loaded the family's luggage into this car. They were going to all go on a family vacation together. A road trip to Vancouver or possibly Niagara Falls. The destination was never clear because it was more about the trip rather than where they'd end up. On their way out of town, they ran into Tuba's brother, Latif. And he was the one his son was going to marry,
yeah,
Zainab.
Yeah, yeah.
He asked Tuba about the plans for Zainab to marry his son, but she seemed out of sorts. She looked scared to him and was just acting funny. He told her, well, bring Zainab back home safe and sound. Tuba's brother, Fazil, was disturbed when he heard about the family heading out on a vacation. because he remembered what Muhammad had said to him about murdering Zainab. He had a very uneasy feeling and feared for the life of his niece.
So all seven of them are in this?
All of them. The okay. entire family.
All right.
All 10 of them. The family left on June 23rd and headed to Grand Rumos, where they stayed in a motel and barbecued. The following day, they headed to Ottawa. The route that the family took, if drawn on a map, looked like a horseshoe, just kind of a weird route. Sahar used her cell phone almost constantly during this vacation, so police were able to retrace their steps because of that, because it just pinged on all the towers. At one point, the family stopped for about 40 minutes right at the King's Mill locks between 8:36 p.m. and 9:16 p.m., and then they went on to Niagara Falls, where they stayed for a few days before checking out on June 29th. As they drove home, Sahar was continually on her phone until 10:54
p.m. What was she doing?
Just texting back and forth. She got a couple phone calls, talked to some friends, but she's always on her phone. And she's texting Ricardo, like, this whole time. Muhammad was driving the Nissan with Zainab, Sahar, Giti, and Rona aboard when he pulled into the Kingston Mills parking lot at about 1:30 a.m. Then Tuba got behind the wheel and stayed with the others while Hamad and Muhammad went and got a hotel room for the night at the Kingston East Motel. When they got there, they said, we need two rooms. And they said, okay, well, how many people are staying? And they kind of were like, nine? Six? They decide on six. Even though I'm going to tell you, the entire family is on this trip, all 10. They said, okay, there'll be six people staying overnight in two rooms. Amy, Bobby, and Catherine were dropped off at the motel at that point, and Hamad and Muhammad drove toward the locks. Tuba left the car and joined them, and what happened next is unclear. However, it's believed that Zainab, Giti, Sahar, and Rona were all drowned by hand in the locks.
They were drowned?
Mm-hmm. Or held underwater until they stopped moving. Because they were found with water in their lungs. Three of them were found with bruises on the tops of their heads.
Well, how do they do it one by one?
I know. And they all had bruises except for Sahar. And that appeared to the medical examiner to mean that they were all hit over the head, except for Sahar. Maybe she was the first one. I don't know. Once they were all unconscious or dead, their bodies were loaded back into the Nissan with the front seat set in the recline position. Then the stage was set. The family wanted to make it look like a tragic accident. Once they arrived to the proper launching area, the car, with its engine still running, was put into proper gear with the idea that the car would propel itself into the water. But that didn't happen. There was a high curb that once the car was put into gear, the front tires cleared the curb, but the rest of the vehicle was left dangling, tires spinning. So one of the family members turned off the car ignition and panic set in because this was their plan, was to just launch the car into the locks. The new plan was for their Lexus SUV, which was the other car they drove, to get behind the Nissan and ram the car into the water. Just push it. That's what was done. But the SUV was damaged from this. The front left headlight was shattered, and after the Nissan ended up in the water, the family scrambled to pick up all the pieces from the grass, but they didn't get them all. The next morning, Hamad called the police at 7:55 a.m. from home in Montreal and reported a fender bender in the parking lot near his home to cover for the SUV's damaged headlight.
So now they're not on vacation. He's back home.
No, just Hamad.
Oh.
He said he accidentally smashed the car into a utility pole. He had driven home to set this story up. Then at 8:30 a.m., he called his father, who was still at the Kingston East Motel, and then he called Sahar's cell phone a couple of times, knowing that she was in the water. He then traveled back to Kingston to meet his family. When he arrived, he, Muhammad, and Tuba set the next part of their plan into motion and took the remaining children to Tim Hortons, dropped them off so we have Amy, Bobby, and Catherine.
I'm sure they had questions.
I'm sure they did, but I'm not sure how old they were. But they dropped them off at Tim Hortons, and Tuba, Muhammad, and Hamid headed to the police station around noon to report Zainab, Sahar, Giti, and Rona missing. And that's when they met with Constable Dempster and told what they already knew. The car had been recovered, and Constable Dempster told them what they already knew. The car had been recovered in the locks. Constable Dempster interviewed Muhammad, Tuba, and Hamid separately, and he got a feeling that what he was hearing wasn't the truth. There was just too many details that didn't seem to add up. The story the family gave the police was that Zainab, who didn't have a driver's license, by the way, she took the car at 2 a.m. to go on a joyride with Rona and her two sisters.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
I know. Come on. When the car must have ended up in the locks in some tragic car accident. The police did an exceptional job piecing together all of the clues and even bugged the family's minivan at one point where they caught the following conversation on tape. So Mohammed says in his native language, Dari, they're lying. If there was a camera, they'd access it in a minute. Tuba agreed with him. There was no camera over there, she said. I looked around. There wasn't any. If, God forbid, there was one in the little room, all three of us would have been recorded. End quote. Hamad was driving and he even warned them, you know, you should probably stop talking because sometimes
they can bug.
They can bug it, but they kept talking. Mohammed said, that night there was no electricity there. Everywhere was pitch darkness. You remember, Tuba? And she says, yes.
Of course you fucking remember.
I know. And he says to her, to hell with them and their boyfriends. Filthy and rotten children.
Oh, man.
Over the next 3 days, police recorded Mohammed just cursing his dead daughters and just being happy that they were dead because they had dishonored their family. He said he was a good father.
Oh,
excellent. He gave them everything, but they betrayed him and acted like whores. And he eventually said, may the devil shit on their graves.
I hate him.
I know.
I hate him. Hate him.
On July 20th, during another conversation, Tuba was saying, I understand basically why we had to kill Zainab, but she wished that the two others, Sahar and Giti, hadn't been killed. But Mohammed was quick to remind her and try to convince her that they had to kill them. He said there was no other way. They betrayed them and they basically took Zainab's side. They were acting the way they were acting, so they had to be killed too. And I'm paraphrasing.
What about Rona?
I know. Rona was thrown in. I don't know. She didn't do anything.
Just for shits and giggles. I know. They would just randomly kill her even though she's been nothing but submissive.
Exactly. At this point, after bugging the minivan, the police had heard enough. And the next day, July 21st, 2009, officers arrived at the Shafia house with a search warrant and arrested Hamad, Tuba, and Mohammed. The children, Amy, Bobby, and Catherine, were removed from the home and placed in foster care. Eventually, they had this wild trial, and I'm not even going to go into it, but Mohammed testified, Tuba testified. Mohammed insisted, you know, he was a good father. Tuba would cry about how she, you know, I would never hurt my children. I'm their mother. It was just disgusting. And the jury saw through all of their bullshit. All three were convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for 25 years. So Mohammed will be in his 80s when he's eligible for parole. Tuba, I believe she'll be in her 60s. And Hamad, the youngest, he'll probably be close to 40.
That's it?
That's it. Because he was a young man. And during their trial, part of Tuba and Mohammed's defense, it seemed, was to blame everything on Hamad, which I thought was really shitty. Because they were all equally guilty for this. But
and he's clearly under the influence of his parents.
Thank you. Exactly. And the police did try to get the true story out of him, but they never really did say the full story. But they had so many witnesses. They had Tuba's brothers, and they had the diary that Rona kept, and they had the calls she made home. And there was so much in the conversations, you know, the girls had with their boyfriends and the emails. And like I said, it was just overwhelming, the amount of evidence that they presented at their trials.
I thought you were going to say, like, they got shot. I can't believe they got
drowned. I know.
That takes time.
That does take time.
And that's very personal.
And planning. Exactly. It was just very cruel.
Very cruel.
So that is my really sad story about the Shafia family.
Well, thanks for sharing that sad, sad pisser.
Thank you, Talia. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And if you haven't already, please hit the subscribe or follow button. If you'd like to see some photos from this episode, you can go to our website, crimesandconsequences.com. There's also a little more information, like the sources, and you can also find out information there on how to become a Patreon member, or you can go to Patreon directly, patreon.com/TNTCrimes. And if you become a Patreon member or subscribe through Apple, you can receive hundreds of unreleased episodes.
Yeah.
We release one every week.
Yes, we do. And a mini every other week.
And a mini every other week. So there's lots of episodes that we don't release to the public.
And then these episodes are ad-free for them.
Yes. They in early release.
Yes. Yeah.
You don't have to wait till Monday. You can get them on Friday with no ads.
Wait till Monday.
Come on, it's worth it, everyone. You can find us on social media at Hardcore True Crime. Hardcore True Crime. On Facebook and Instagram. And if you haven't already, you can watch episode 144.
Yes.
On YouTube.
True Crime Daily.
The True Crime Daily channel. So check it out if you haven't.
See what we look like. Don't insult us. It's not fucking nice.
Exactly. You can watch Talia tell the story and my reactions.
Yeah.
It's awesome. Do it if you haven't already.
Yeah. Episode 144, True Crime Daily channel.
Yes.
YouTube.
So do it and leave a nice comment.
Yes.
I don't want to hear. Yeah. I don't want to see your ugly comments.
No nasty ones.
No nasty ones. So everyone, until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.
Bye.